Where warp meets weft.
Where warp meets weft.
This is Weavecast with Sine Mitchell.
Hello, and welcome to episode 29, Spinning for Weaving. This episode, we have the wonderfully talented Judith McKenzie McCune here to talk to us about how to spin yarn specifically for weaving. She was our very first interviewee back on episode one, and it is absolute delight to catch up with her and see what she's been doing recently. I have an update on the Afghans for Afghans project. There is a Flickr site where you can see some of the wonderful shawls that volunteers have been creating. It is fun to see those finished. Each one is different, and they are all beautiful. Thank you to all the people who have been weaving for that. Some of the yarn that came in was not really usable. It was either too thick or too scratchy, or in a couple of cases, cotton. So that yarn I donated to a store in Seattle called A Good Yarn. This store takes yarn donations in, and all of the profits made from selling that yarn go to support advocacy programs for women and children who are victims of domestic violence. I hope if you're one of the people who donate the yarn, you agree that was a good choice for what to do with the yarn that wouldn't work for this project. Now, one of the weavers asked me how my shawl was going, and I will confess it is still on the loom. This has been one of those weaving projects where if anything can go wrong, it will. I mean, it even had the classic moment where I'm watching the lee sticks sliding out of the cross, and I'm 5 yards away winding on the warp, and it's sliding out so slowly, but yet fast enough that I could not get there in time. So not only did I make every possible mistake, but I ended up having to wind on and warp this loom with no cross, 24 ends per inch, 22 over 2, very sticky merino. And you know what? It seems to be on the loom fine now. All I can say is it's the miracle of wool. Wool is a very forgiving fiber, and I think I've got it all sorted out. I'm getting a good shed. I'm weaving plain weave. The project is going to be an 8-shaft huck lace. There'll be huck lace diamonds in the body of this turquoise fine merino wool. And as annoying as this project was to get on the loom, the woven fabric I am in love with. It is so light and floaty and delicate. This is my first time weaving with fine wool, and I am just loving the result. It is wonderfully light and dainty. And the really good news is I checked the Afghans for Afghans website, and they have moved the deadline for getting shawls to them out to the end of July. So I've got a little extra time to weave. If you're thinking about this or you're in process, you've got a little extra time to weave. If you've been working on this, thank you. It is such a good cause, and it's really been a lot of fun to see what people come up with. Linda Hartshorn sent me a silver coin that's minted by a community in California. Now, this is part of a series of coins that celebrate self-sufficiency, and this coin had a weaver working at her loom on the back, and there's also a spinning wheel in the picture. It is so cool. Thank you, Linda, for sending this to me. I'll have a picture of the coin on the show notes and a link to more information about the project. I have come to the realization that my studio is loom locked. I have for the past 6 years been really good at finding deals on used looms and not so good at selling them. It was that beginning weaver's quest to find the perfect loom that I could afford. And so I migrated from a 4-shaft baby wolf to an 8-shaft baby wolf to a mighty wolf. I think I would be a more productive weaver if I didn't have to shift looms out of the way every time I started a new project. And at this point in my weaving career, I have a better idea of what kind of loom would suit me best. And I've come to realize that you don't have to have a loom that does it all. Only a loom that weaves the kind of cloth you want to weave. And it doesn't mean that you have to want to weave that kind of cloth forever, just for right now. So I'm going to be selling off my looms, except for that one that I learned to weave on, because it's just near and dear to my heart. It's my Wooby Comfort Loom. I'm not selling the four-shaft Baby Wolf. But all the other looms I'm going to be selling off, and while I'm at Convergence, I'm going to be test driving looms to see what my perfect loom is. In other news, there's an online palette generator that's great for creating sets of coordinated colors for you to use in your weaving projects. If you're one of those people who has trouble imagining what five or six colors would go together well, you can use this online tool and give it one color and it'll come up with some coordinating colors. On YouTube, Sherry Hankins has been posting some educational snippets of weaving how-tos. They cover a range of topics, including things as diverse as hem stitching, warping the loom, many other things. We'll have a link to that on the show notes. I applaud her for getting some of that weaving information out there on the internet. Next up, we have an interview with Judith McKenzie McCune, the lady who taught me to weave and one of my favorite weaving instructors. To get you in the mood for our discussion of spinning for weaving, I'm going to play you a song by Claire Downing called Spinning Wheel. Spinning. Lovely and talented Judith McKenzie McEwen. I am delighted to have her on the show again. She was our very first interviewee when I was very new at this, and you could hear my knees knocking beneath the table. It's a delight to have her back on the show to talk to us about spinning for weaving. Welcome.
Thanks, Sian. And it's just a great pleasure to be here again.
We've gotten a lot of requests for learning how to spin specifically for weaving, but I'm curious about the differences between spinning for weaving versus spinning for knitting, which is what most people learn first.
Had we been having this conversation 30 years ago, there would have been no question about whether you could spin for knitting. It just wasn't done. But you could spin for weaving, mostly weft yarns, and most of the guild approach to spinning for weaving would have said, well, you can spin your weft yarn, but of course you can't hand spin your warp. And that would sort of wipe out about 7,000 years of textile history in a single blow. Of course, we can spin for warp and weft both easily and comfortably. And the difference between spinning for knitting and spinning for weaving, primarily it's a question of strength. I think if I talk to people, they would assume that, oh, yes, the weaving yarns have to be stronger. Well, in fact, it's actually the other way around. A knitting yarn has to take the whole pressure of the garment on a single thread. It's what's called a mono-element technique. It has one thread that carries the whole garment. In weaving, we have this wonderful thing that happens where tension and strength is distributed through many, many threads. All the different threads in the warp can take the tension and divide the wear and tear, and the interlacement makes the cloth stronger. So you can use a lot more tender and delicate thread in weaving than you could in knitting. So when I'm looking at a knitting yarn, I'm looking very carefully at structure. And one of the big things about structure, apart from strength, is what does the yarn do when it actually is used? What happens to it when it goes into a loop or rolls along in the weft yarn? And in knitting, it's a curious thing. A two-ply yarn is not your best choice as a knitting yarn, unless you are doing some very specific technique like lace. When you're knitting, you make a loop with the yarn, and that yarn can move in two ways. If it's a two-ply yarn, it's going to move away from the center of the stitch and enhance the shape of the whole. If you make a three or more ply yarn, then we would call that a multiple ply yarn, it opens up towards the center of the stitch and will roll into the center, filling up the hole and making a dense, wonderful fabric, smooth, even, and lovely. If you use a two-ply, you'll always see more of the movement of the thread, which would be a good reason to use it if you needed it for stitch definition. In the same way that a single is often used because of its wildness and its unrepressible movement, we might use a single in knitting because it shows the movement of the thread very elaborately and, as I said, almost uncontrollably. If you look at Catherine Alexander's work, you can see it do tricks. You can see it in weaving yarns too. But a two-ply yarn in weaving does a very specific thing. It makes a perfect lock. If you look at a two-ply yarn, you'll see that the little edge looks serrated. It's not round and smooth like a multiple-ply yarn. When you put that in the warp and you run a two-ply weft across it, they form an interlock that holds the fiber together and holds it apart so that it locks it together for strength, holds it apart for lightweight, drapeability, all those things. So we would use always a two-ply unless we had a really good reason not to. The other thing about the two-ply that's really interesting is that if you reverse the twist between the warp and the weft, they will slip by one another and the angle of the ply twist will all match up, or the angle of the spin twist, if they're singles, will all match up, allowing them to not interlock, but to slip by and make a smooth, lustrous surface. It will reflect back the light in a long, unbroken line. It will be denser because the interlock that we use when we use the same direction of twist in the two-ply, in both the warp and the weft, in that case, they interlock and don't allow the fibers to slip by. It'll be denser, heavier, but it would be what you would use for satin weave or damask or anything where you wanted a smooth, lustrous surface or where you wanted that kind of wear, like in upholstery, where you want it to shed dirt, in clothing, where you want it to shed water, wherever you want more weft packed in, choose alternate twist. It's tricky nowadays to find alternate twist. It used to be standard practice for hand weavers to have alternate twist. Olsner and Dale has a great chapter on twist direction in his book that I think is well worth reading in conjunction with how twills look, which direction of twist you should use for the weft and the warp to make your twills come out perfectly.
That's the Handbook of Weaves from Dover?
Yeah, everybody should have it under their pillow while they're sleeping. It's a great book. Just be calm when you open it up. Don't panic. There are no pictures. They're just these funny little diagrams, but read it. I've read it I don't know how many times, and every time I go back, I've learned just enough more to get another little gem out of it. And then he does deal a lot with types of yarns, and I think you'll find that true in Peter Collingwood too.
You've talked about different plies and how they affect the weaving. What about worsted versus woolen?
In spinning, we divide yarns up into two big families, worsted, where the fibers are all twisted after they're brought into a parallel structure. So the fibers all run side by side, and then the twist enters it, and then you stretch out more and side by side, and the twist enters it. And we can make worsted yarns from all sorts of preparation, but ideally to make the perfect 10 out of 10 worsted, it will be a luster long wool that's been combed and then oiled or wet spun so that everything stayed in place and nothing could move sideways, and you have ultimate strength. In woolen, we do exactly the opposite. Everything goes in kind of higgledy-piggledy, as many deliberate crosses as possible. The twist runs into it, swirling it around even more, and then the twist is drafted up into it. That makes for a web-like structure in the yarn that traps a lot of air, makes lots of cellular spaces in it, weighs hardly anything. And it's about 97% air, good woolen yarn. It's not strong, of course. In knitting, we very rarely use a true woolen yarn. It would be unusual to find commercially a true woolen yarn. We could find woolens maybe in tweeds that have bad woolen preparation, but they've probably been spun in a semi-woolen, a semi-worsted method. That's not doing a true woolen. When you hear people talk about mule spun in commercial yarns like Green Mountain Spinnery and Custom Woolen Works in Carstairs, they both have mule spinners.
What's a mule spinner?
Oh, it is a lovely thing to watch. It's really interesting. If you're interested in spinning, going to mills is just a great field trip. A mule spun, the whole head of the machinery moves back and the yarn is pulled out. And then the twist is popped in and it moves forward. So it drafts it out. You pop the twist in, it moves forward. There's very few machines like that nowadays. If you have a mini mill, you don't have a woolen system. True woolen systems are a bit unusual. In hand spinning, people do variations on woolen spinning for knitting. If you looked at commercial yarns, you'd be hard pressed to find one. Mostly that's because of the strength issue. I would say a classic woolen prepared with a short, uneven fiber, prepared on a carder, rolled, and then spun with a woolen long draw, you know, where you pull back and let the twist race up into it, is probably very rarely used. Woolen spinning has a limited use for a hand knitter. It isn't very strong. It can be very tender, very hard to get off the bobbin, very hard to ply. So woolen yarns are primarily used as weft yarns, whether they're hand spun or commercially spun.
Are there any cases where a woolen yarn would be suitable for warp?
No. Well, true, hardcore woolen, no. No, 1,000 times no. Well, you wouldn't have to worry about it for very long because you would only try it once and you'd only try it briefly. And that would be that. As you sat there with piles of fluff around your feet, you'd say, wow, not doing that again. It would be nice to not have to make that kind of mistake, but I certainly have made it. That's how come I know about it. I can remember once putting a single silk noil that I'd spun myself on the warp, and as I rotated the loom, you know, when you turn that back beam on the loom, you have made a spinning machine, and I took twist out of it, and I tried, and it was like weaving wet Kleenex. It was appalling, just appalling. But you can do it what's called an attenuated long draw, which is, I think some people call double drafting. Well, this would be double drafting with a vengeance. So it's similar to how you'd spin cotton, where you draft it out and then let the twist run in and then work your fingers back and forth to make it very strong, high twist. For short fibers like the silk noil, they can't be spun true worsted. And this is the one way that you can make a warp yarn out of them. It would be a really good project to make a warp yarn out of something that is a bit fragile. I use bison a lot for a warp, and it is as short as anything you're likely to find, short as any cotton. You really don't want to look at how short it is before you start spinning it. But I've used a sort of modification of that attenuated long draw to make a warp out of it. I think I could warp with it all by itself, but I often support it with one other thread running beside it.
A small silk or something?
Could use a small silk. In this case, what I'm using is a blend between either a fine merino or a fine cashmere top and a single of bison and a single of my hand spun. A silk cashmere blend is what I've been using most, and I like it quite a lot. And it gives a nice hand and a little gleam. I'm very happy with that.
When you're spinning a warp, aside from using a long fiber and spinning primarily worsted?
Yeah, you're going to spin, for warp yarns, I'd probably spin worsted or worsted derivative, you know, one of the 10,000 variations. And what divides worsted from woolen is simply where the twist goes. If the twist goes into fibers that are already stretched out, that makes them side by side. It's called attenuated in the textile world. They're attenuated. They will be as strong as they possibly can be. So you stretch them, that gives them strength, strangely enough. And then add the twist to those stretched out fibers so they can't move sideways. All the pressure runs the length of the fiber, and that keeps them strong. All the ends are tucked in, so that helps too. So there's two things we have to think about when we're making a warp yarn. We have to think about strength. It has to be strong enough to take the tension that it's going to be under as the threads are either moved up or down. They also have to withstand abrasion. That's rubbing back and forth. Those are all different kinds of wear that they'll encounter. The longer the fibers are, the less abrasion you have because the less little ends are sticking out. The finer the fiber is, curiously enough, the stronger the fiber is. The more fibers you can put into the circle of your yarn, the stronger it is by a huge amount. The more fibers there are in that circle, no matter what diameter it is, if you got a thick yarn or a thin yarn, the more individual fibers that are twisted, the stronger it is. So if you can get a lot of fibers in a small space and twist them together, they will be as strong as a few fibers in that same space. So often we try to make yarns, especially out of Leicester long wools, like a Romney or a Lincoln or a Cotswold. We think that they will be stronger because the fiber itself is. We'd probably do just as well to use a 22 micron alpaca if we're thinking about strength, because you can get way more individual fibers out of a 22 micron alpaca than you can out of Lincoln or Romney.
You've recommended using two-ply yarns for warps. Are there any times when you would want to warp with a single, and can you make a warp with singles?
Oh, sure you can. The thing is that you have to have a reason to do it. The reason would never be that it takes less time, because it doesn't. One of the things that singles will do, they don't have a balancing twist in them. And a balancing twist doesn't mean that the yarn is lying dead straight, because I'm not really a fan of what we think of as balanced yarns, where they hang in a big lazy loop. I'd like them to have just a little more energy so they can go through either the knitting process or the weaving process and still have enough twist to make fabric that's balanced. When you put two singles together, they're like an arch. They lean against one another. And when their energy touches, they become still. And guess what a single doesn't have? It has no stillness in it at all. It is a wild yarn, and that's why you'd use it. You'd use it because you like that wild movement in it, and it was going to do something that I can't say would always be predictable. It has a mind of its own, and it's looking for something to tangle with. Putting a single warp on, especially a high twist one, is something that you want to spend a little time thinking about. You're going to have to take a little extra care to put that warp on. I use very similar to the kind of tension box you use on a sectional warper. I'll make that up with doweling in a box so that I have maybe 5 or 6 layers of dowels that those threads go over so that they're moving up and down and not touching one another so that they don't make a novelty yarn before they get on a loom. I just taught a class out in Forks where we use the idea of using yarns that will twist together in the heddle. Normally, you're always going to thread singly through the heddles. You can put as many as you like through the reed, but you put it singly through the heddles. Well, you can do very interesting things, especially with wild single yarn, by putting them in multiples through a heddle. They'll cord in the heddle. They'll actually spin together as the loom advances, as you move the warp forward. They'll spin around one another and form a decorative cord right down the center of your cloth.
And that just sounds so terrifying to try to get that warp on.
It is a bit unnerving. But you know what Itten says? He says that if you want to go someplace on a long journey, you do something safe and you take a car. But if you want to go someplace interesting, you have to get out and walk. That's kind of like that. You want to try interesting things. And being a hand spinner, you have a huge range of things that you can try. I think when most people think about spinning for weaving, they think about making right from the fiber, singles and moving on as a traditional spinner would. But I'd like to make a really good strong plug for reconfiguring yarns. I've for a number of years offered a class on spinning for weavers. And I mean this for weavers and not for spinners. But who comes to my class, of course, are spinners who would like to be weavers. I would love to have weavers who want to make good yarn, interesting yarn out of what's available to them, because yarns can be remade. We have an astonishing source of yarns available, both in singles and very fine 2-plies or 3-plies, and we can bundle them. We can reverse the twist on them. We can put more twist on them. We can take less twist on them, and we can create very interesting cloth. Let's say you had a couple of cones of zephyr. You could make zephyr into 50 different kinds of yarn, and they would all work together, and you would have something that not everybody else would have. You would have something that was unique. Your cloth would grow out of your understanding of the movement of the thread. And I think that is an interesting thing to do. And you can combine many, many things. Many of the spinning techniques that I like to make novelty yarns with are based not on making the singles, but on making the yarn structures. As I said, sort of reconfiguring commercial yarns. You're playing with the plies, adding things to it, adding beads, adding feathers, adding mohair or cloth, recycled elements, as many things you can do. They make wonderful warp yarns. I'm a real fan, if you're going to make yarns for warp, that you think very seriously about putting all your texture in the warp.
You're not saying I should put feathers on warp yarn?
Yes, I am. Feathers, beads.
My expression right now, it's kind of gobsmacked.
Yeah. Well, it is easier. And it looks better, and it's way easier to weave. You have a lot more unity in your cloth if all the texture, line, and color is in the warp. And then you weave across it with a single weft to unify it and pull it together. As a production weaver from long ago, I'm not going to change that weft yarn unless I absolutely have to. I would if I had to, but I'm going to plan, plot, and connive to make sure I get as much of the change in the warp. So I'm going to put the warp on once. That's all I'm going to do.
As someone who learned to weave from you, I'm totally with you on the design and color in the warp, but I'm going back to feathered warp
yarn. Why ever not?
How do you make a feathered warp yarn that will survive?
Oh, it will. If it's strong enough to be a yarn, it'll survive.
But won't the feathers rub off when it goes through the heddles?
You will be surprised how little they'll actually come off. And I've woven with beaded yarns too.
In the warp?
In the warp. I had to be kind of cautious about big beads, like Zuni fetishes. They had to be able to go through the reed. But the eyes of the heddles are amazingly large. For my spinning class, I've started carrying around heddles and saying, look, I can put this double through there and I can pull it back and forth. Look, it compacts and it goes through. The yarn looks like a solid object. It isn't. It's air. That's what most good yarns are. They're mostly air. Even a really, really good, firm, tight worsted yarn is 75% air. So when it goes through that heddle eye, it'll compact very nicely, and many of them don't even touch the outsides when they're folded twice.
I've just made homework for myself. I'm going to go spin with feathers and put it in the warp and see what happens.
Yeah. Try goose down first. It's wonderful. You can get it from Eddie Bauer in those little pouches.
little pouches?
Yeah, to repair your sleeping bags and outdoor clothes. They sell it in a little pouch. It's perfect.
No, yeah. Okay, I'll try that. What about the equipment that you're using to weave with hand spun? Are there any special requirements, say for heddles, that you would recommend, like Texol versus metal?
I think one of the big fears people have when they look at their yarn, especially a big loop boucle or very, very textured yarn, is that it won't go through the heddles. And one of the first things I'd say is try it. Just try it. Keep a heddle on hand while you're spinning and see if your yarn will actually go through it. Rub it back and forth a few times. Is it okay? If it's okay, use that heddle. An experience you and I both had was when you'd put on a super fine warp with a flat metal heddles that have the heddle eyes just kind of punched out of it. I'd be cautious with those, especially if you've done a really fine hand spun or were working with cashmere, bison, anything that might abrade. They tend to have little razor sharp edges on them. And if your threads are the least bit delicate, they're gone. So they certainly are a heddle that I'm not terribly fond of. The inserted eye heddle is great. You can put almost anything through it. Texolve is interesting. For years, I made blankets with my big loop wolf yarn, my big boucle yarn, as the warp and as the weft.
This is the textured mohair that's almost like a pencil thickness?
Yeah, but it's all air, so it just pops through whatever heddle you put it through. But I had a Glamocker at the time, which had string heddles that I made. I made the string heddles. I made bigger eyes on them, and that worked just fine for a while. Then I wanted to modernize my loom a little bit. I changed over to a Texolve system on it, and bless me if the mohair didn't start to wrap right into the Texolve. So I found that very hairy yarns that have a lot of loose fiber on them, say an Angora, that would be a prime example where it starts to have a bit of a halo on it. They tend to spin right into the Texolve heddles. So I would use wire heddles on those. But I have to tell you that what I did for a lot of my weaving when I was doing quite large yarns is I did simply what Peter Collingwood or many very adventuresome weavers would do. I made my own heddles, and I did that by taking the old thin wire heddles. I cut them right through the heddle eye, inserted a brass drapery ring, you can get it at any fabric store, and then twisted the cut heddle eye back up, twisted it in tightly, and that gave me a big heddle that was about the size of a penny, and I could have put anything through that. For years I used that, and it worked very well. You don't need that many of them, so it's not that onerous. If you're weaving on yarn that big in your warp, you probably are warping it at the most 6 ends to the inch, so you only need a few. But I really don't like changing heddles back and forth. It's my least favorite job, and there's no good reason for that. I know how to do it, and I can do it efficiently. I just don't like it. So one day it dawned on me that I could just order more frames. And I ordered frames, put those big heddles on there. I just take them off and on the loom when I want to. You can modify your loom. It's your loom, and you can make it work the way you want it to. If you need to change the reed, you can take that reed apart. You can take pieces out of it. If you have ever seen Peter Collingwood's reeds, he has them all soldered together in different sets because it's really convenient for him to have bands of different sets all through his work, and you certainly can do that too.
I never even thought about making your own heddles.
Yeah, isn't that funny? It's like somehow our machinery is sacrosanct and intact when it comes to us, and that we must obey. But it isn't true. It's really yours. Modify it to work for you.
Last year, you published a book called Teach Yourself Visually Hand Spinning. What were your goals in writing that book?
Oh, I did that for Wiley Press. And Wiley is probably the biggest textbook manufacturer that we have. They came to me and asked me if I would do this. It's a very structured book. It has a definite mission. It's to teach you through pictures and very simple instructions. It isn't meant to have your own voice at all. It was an instruction manual. I've been happy with it. In the last year, I've had a lot of especially young new spinners who live in rural areas come up to me and say, I have your book and I had a spinning wheel and look at this. So it's been rewarding for me. It's certainly not meant to be the definitive book on spinning, but a good place to start out for a beginner.
The pictures in it are lovely. And although you said it's true, you don't get a lot of Judith McKenzie's special opinions and voice, you do get a lot of clear and easy to follow instruction.
That's Chris. It's very good. She's a wonderful editor and very good educator. I learned a lot from her. Yeah.
I saw on Amazon that you've got a new book coming out from Interweave Press called The Intentional Spinner, A Holistic Approach to Making Yarn.
I do. I worked on it last year on the road and then at home during the winter.
So how is this book going to be different than the first?
It is more my book. It's for an intermediate level spinner, for instance. That would make a big difference. What I wanted to do was give a good in-depth explanation of many of the things that I did in the Wiley book. I wanted to answer questions that I didn't even think a beginner spinner would even ask. I think you have to be spinning for a while before you say, now just a tiny second, why does this happen and how does this work? And as a teacher, I've watched a change in the questions that people ask me in the last 20 years. People are more interested in both the science behind spinning and yarn, but they're also interested in the art, what I think of as the why we spin. And I've tried to address both of those things. So I have a good bit of information about fibers and how they're made, what they're made of, what they do, what they can't do, all the properties of fibers and how to test them. And I have information on the why of it, like why do we spin and what it means to me. In this one, it is my voice and I have my own stories that I can tell about why I spin.
I'm intrigued by the title. What do you mean by an intentional spinner?
Well, it's like this. When I first started spinning, I would say I was first class member of the Happy Accident School of Textile Design, and I was just grateful. That's the word, grateful for anything that I could get off the wheel. As I spun more and more, I wanted to have some idea of what I was doing it for. If you want to spin worsted, you want to spin woolen, you have an intention. What do you want to do with it? It's like physics. Whether you believe in gravity or not, you are going to fall out of that tree. Yarn design is exactly the same way. Yarn will do certain things under certain conditions. And wishing won't make a whit of difference. I thought it would be helpful for people if they could see what the basic movement of thread was, why it did certain things, then they could make an informed choice about what they wanted it to do. And the wheels work in certain ways. Wishing that a bobbin-driven wheel wouldn't pull on so fast is fine, but it still will. You know. So how you choose a wheel, how it works, what you can do to make it work differently, a little bit of that, but mostly about fibers and what plying, what cabling, what different draws do. That's mainly what the book is about. And I have a chapter in there called Preserve and Protect, about not only how to, but why to keep records and why to keep the stories about your material, why we do what we do, and a nasty little bit about moths.
What other projects are coming up over the horizon for you?
I've worked out in Forks a lot in the last 10, 15 years. And Forks is a little town that's very similar to where I grew up in Squamish, a logging town where logging has finished and there we are. And it's on the edge of the world. I'm hoping next year to have a workshop out there that will take people to Nea Bay and have a visit with ancient textiles there that I have found absolutely fascinating and inspiring. And then meet some of the people who are still working in textiles there. I'm quite excited about that project. And Morgane Wilder and I have the Golden Gate Institute in San Francisco, where we're structuring different types of classes. Morgane and I, we both travel a lot. We've been interested in how many times we find really interesting textile people who don't have really wide exposure. So we're pairing them with instructors who have wider exposure, putting that together so that they get an introduction to a bigger audience. And that's been very fun for us.
As we wrap things up, what do you think is the most important thing to keep in mind if you are somebody who's been spinning for a while and wants to start using your hand spun in your woven cloth?
Just remember that 7,000 years can't be wrong. Just put it on the loom. Be brave. Don't even worry about it. You would be surprised. It is way, way easier than you think, and it's way more forgiving. You don't have to make something you can tow trucks out of ditches with. There's nothing as much fun as making a cloth out of your own hand spun.
Thank you so much for talking to us.
Oh, you're welcome, Sign. It's lovely as always.
And now it's time for today's audio essay. Spinning for Collapsed Fabric. I came into weaving from spinning, and so it's really surprising to me that I haven't done more weaving with my hand spun. I think it's because hand spun is so precious that I'm just afraid to put it on the loom and have that loom waste and have things potentially go awry. But I've started to take baby steps into weaving with my hand spun, and each time it has just been lovely. The first time I wove with hand spun, it actually wasn't my hand spun. It was that scarf that I described in a previous episode where somebody had thrown away a pile of miscellaneous balls of yarn and I created random warps out of it. And some of those balls of yarn were precious hand spun. It looked like silk hand spun. I think that would be a great exercise for a guild or group of weaving friends to get over the hump of their fear of weaving with hand spun, is that you have a party where everybody brings a bag of hand spun. Then at the party, hands it to the person on their right. So everybody brings a bag, everybody takes home a bag, and then you go home and weave, but you're weaving with somebody else's hand spun, so it's not as fearful. That's my idea for a fun weaving party. After I had woven on a rigid heddle with someone else's hand spun, I thought it was time to spin something specifically for a weaving project. And one of the things I'd wanted to play around with were collapse fabrics, where it helps to have an over-twisted weft. Over-twisted wefts are spindy and often hard to find. But as Judith McKenzie McCune will tell you, if you have a spinning wheel, you are your own yarn factory. I bought some beautiful hand-painted cashmere silk blend roving from Chasing Rainbows. Stunning stuff. And I spun it into a very thin single. And what I did with the warp was I used a commercial silk because I wanted all of the collapse to be in the weft. I didn't want any collapse in the warp. And frankly, if I waited until I had spun enough perfect yarn for warp, I'd be waiting forever. So I used a commercial yarn for the warp and I picked two colors. I picked a bluey red and a purple. It was kind of an eggplant purple. And I put that on the loom in stripes. I got this idea from a Best of Weavers book called Fabrics That Go Bump. The way it worked was you had a stripe of a 3-1 twill alternating with a stripe of a 1-3 twill. The 3-1 twill tended to have more weft on one side, and the 1-3 twill had more weft on the other side. So that caused the structure of the fabric to want to create furrows. And then if you cross that with an over-twisted weft, that just increases the depth of the furrows. I wove a little sample at the beginning using the commercial yarn that had absolutely no twist or energy in it. I got a teeny amount of furrowing after I had wet finished it, but the body of the scarf that I wove with the hand-spun over-twisted single, when it came off the loom, it had a little bit of furrowing, and it had a little bit more furrowing than the part that had been woven with the commercial yarn. But when it hit the water, it pleated all by itself. It was beautiful. It was one of those magical moments. I put it in the water, I grabbed the two ends of the scarf, and I snapped it like a belt, and the pleats formed, and they're permanent. And it's lovely. It's lovely. The variegation of the hand-painted roving, it's really interesting how the two colors of warp interacted with that. On one side, you see mostly the eggplant color, but if you open up the pleats, you can see the sparkling, bright colors of the painted roving. And on the other side, you see mostly the bluey red until you open up the pleats, and then you see the painted roving. So it's like a little secret on each side. And because I use two different colors for the warp, I can coordinate it with my red clothing, and I can coordinate it with my purple clothing. Overall, it was a very successful project, and I really enjoyed working on it. I actually wove that at a weaving retreat with Judith McKenzie, so this has kind of been a very, very Judith episode. That's all for this episode, and now it's time to get warped, because everyone knows you have to be warped to weave. I'm going to play you out with a fun song that I think could be the theme of just about any spin-in.
Spin, spin, spin like a spider web. Spin, spin, spin like a spinning top. Spin, spin, spin till you're dizzy in your head and you fall to the floor. Until you get up once more and you spin again. Spin, spin, spin like a tornado. Spin, spin, spin like a politician. Spin, spin, spin till you're dizzy in your head and you fall to the floor. Until you get up once more and you spin again. You spin again. You spin again. You spin again. Again. Spin, 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 spin.
Weavecast is brought to you through the generosity of its donating listeners. This episode, I'd like to thank Shirley, Jane, and Linda. Our musical guests this episode include E. Tranger's Mind Spin, Claire Downing's Spinning Wheel, and John Caspi's song, Spin, a song for children of all ages.